Chapter 1, The Rothschilds. Part 1 in its issue of December 19, 1983, Forbes magazine noted that half of Germany's top 10 banks are Frankfurt-based. The Modern World's Financial System, an updating of the Babylonian monetary system of taxes and money creation, was perfected in Frankfurt on Main, in the province of Hesse. Myram Schulbauer, later Rothschild, discovered that although loans to farmers and small businesses could be profitable, the real profits lay in making loans to governments. Born in Frankfurt in 1743, Myram Schulbauer married Gutta Schnapper. He served a three-year apprenticeship in Hanover at the Bank of Oppenheim. During this period, he had occasion to be of service to Lieutenant General Baron von Estorff. Von Estorff was the principal advisor to Landgrave Frederick I of Hesse, the wealthiest man in Europe. Frederick was worth from 70 to 100 million florins, much of it inherited from his father, Wilhelm VIII, brother of the King of Sweden. Baron von Estorff advised the Landgrave that Myram Schulbauer showed an uncanny ability to increase money through his investments. The Landgrave immediately sent for him. At this time, King George I was trying to put down the American Rebellion. His troops were being outfought by the hardy Americans, who were accustomed to wilderness battles. Myram Schulbauer arranged for King George to hire 16,800 sturdy young Hessian soldiers from the Landgrave, a considerable addition to the Hesse's fortune. This advantageous relationship came to a halt with the sudden death in 1785 of the Landgrave, who was only 25 years old. However, Myram Schulbauer attained absolute influence over his successor, Elector Wilhelm I, who, like Myram Schulbauer, had also been born in 1743. It was said that they were like two shoes, so well did they go together. It was a pleasant change from Myram Schulbauer's relationship with the former Landgrave, who had been a very difficult and demanding person. In fact, the Landgrave's sudden death had luckily placed Myram Schulbauer in charge of the largest fortune in Europe. As he prospered, Myram Schulbauer placed a large red shield over his door of the house in the Judengasse, which he shared with the Siff family. He took the name Rothschild from his sign. In 1812, when he died, he left 1 billion francs to his five sons. The eldest, Anselm, was placed in charge of the Frankfurt Bank. He had no children, and the bank was later closed. The second son, Salomon, was sent to Vienna, where he soon took over the banking monopoly formerly shared among five Jewish families, Arnstein, Esks, Jemer, Stein and Sina. The third son, Nathan, founded the London branch, after he had profited in some Manchester dealings in textiles and dyestuffs which caused him to be widely feared and hated. Karl, the fourth son, went to Naples, where he became head of the occult group, the Alta Vendita. The youngest son, James, founded the French branch of the House of Rothschild in Paris. Thus strategically located, the five sons began their lucrative operations in government finance. Today, their holdings are concentrated in the Five Arrows Fund of Curaçao, and the Five Arrows Corporation Toronto, Canada. The name is taken from the Rothschild sign of an eagle with five arrows clutched in its talons, signifying the five sons. The first precept of success in making government loans lies in creating a demand, that is, by taking part in the creation of financial panics, depressions, famines, wars and revolutions. The overwhelming success of the Rothschilds lay in their willingness to do what had to be done. As a Frederick Morton writes in the preface to the Rothschilds, for the last 150 years, the history of the House of Rothschild has been to an amazing degree the backstage history of Western Europe. Because of their success in making loans not to individuals but to nations, they reaped huge profits. Someone once said that the wealth of Rothschild consists of the bankruptcy of nations. In the Empire of the City, E.C. Knuth says, the fact that the House of Rothschild made its money in the great crashes of history and the great wars of history, the very periods when others lost their money, is beyond question. On July 8, 1937, the New York Times noted that Professor Wilhelm, a German historian, had said, "The Rothschilds introduced the rule of money into European politics. The Rothschilds were the servants of money who undertook to reconstruct the world as an image of money and its functions. Money and the employment of wealth have become the law of European life. We no longer have nations, but economic provinces." On June 4, 1879, the New York Times noted, Baron Lionel N. Rothschild, head of the world-famous banking house of Messrs. Rothschild and Company, died at the age of 71. He was son of the late Baron N. M. Rothschild, who founded the house in London in 1808 and died in 1836. His father came to the conclusion that in order to perpetuate the fame and power of the Rothschilds, which had already become worldwide, it was necessary that the family be kept together, and devoted to the common cause. In order to do this, he proposed that they should intermarry, and form no marital unions outside the family. A council of the heads of the houses was called at Frankfurt in 1826, and the views of Baron Nathan were approved. In The Rothschilds, The Financial Rulers of Nations, John Reeves writes, "The first occasion in which Nathan assisted the English government was in 1819, when he undertook the loan of $60 million. From 1818 to 1832, Nathan issued 8 other loans totaling $105,400,000. He subsequently issued 18 government loans totaling $700 million. To the Rothschilds, nothing could have occurred more propitiously than the outbreak of the American Revolt and the French Revolution, as that to enable them to lay the foundation of the immense wealth they have since acquired. The House of Rothschild was, and is, the ruling power in Europe, for all the political powers were willing to acknowledge the sway of the great financial despot, and, like obedient vassals, pay their tribute without murmur. Its influence was so all-powerful that it was a saying, no war could be undertaken without the assistance of the Rothschilds. They rose to a position of such power in the political and commercial world that they became the dictators of Europe." To the public, the archives of the family, which could throw so much light upon history, are a profound secret, a sealed book kept well hidden. On July 27, 1844, Mazzini said, "Rothschild could be king of France if he so desired." The Jewish Encyclopedia noted, 1909 edition, "In the year 1848 the Paris house, of Rothschild, was reckoned to be worth 600 million francs as against 352 million francs held by all the other Paris bankers." Professor Werner Sombart wrote, "The principal loan floaters of the world, the Rothschilds, were later the first railway kings. The period of 1820 onwards became the age of the Rothschilds, so that at the middle of the century it was a common dictum, there is only one power in Europe, and that is Rothschild. Jews and modern capitalism." Hearst's Chicago Evening American commented, December 3, 1923, "The Rothschilds can start or prevent wars. Their word could make or break empires." Reeves notes, "The fall of Napoleon was the rise of Rothschild. Napoleon was later slowly poisoned to death with arsenic by a Rothschild agent. They had no need of another return from exile." The New York Evening Post noted July 22, 1924, "The Kaiser had to consult Rothschild to find out whether he could declare war. Another Rothschild carried out the whole burden of the conflict which overthrew Napoleon. The Kaiser's Chancellor, Bethmann Hoegg, who actually precipitated World War I, was a member of the Frankfurt banking family, Bethmann, and a cousin of the Rothschilds. After the fall of Napoleon, Salomon persuaded the ruler of Austria to issue patents of nobility to the five brothers. The Congress of Vienna was the emergence of them from its cocoon. The diktat of this Congress was a simple one: the aristocracies of Europe must submit to our will, or they are doomed. The death sentence upon the noble lines of Europe was pronounced by those who had the will to carry out their edict. It took another century to perfect the work, not because the killers were weak, but because they wished to proceed cautiously, without revealing their full strength. In combat, the decisive weapon is the one your opponent does not know about. It was not necessary to pronounce a death sentence upon the ruling families of America, because there were none. During the 19th century, a few descendants of colonial entrepreneurs had amassed wealth, and could afford a life of leisure and travel. They remained slavishly dependent upon continental arbiters in every matter requiring personal taste and judgment. Because they had no guiding philosophy, and no program, this American upper class never made it to the top of the stairs. They remained below stairs as servants of the London princes of the world order. Their self-abasement not only manifested itself in an unusually high rate of suicide, but also in the slower forms of self-destruction, alcoholism, drug addiction, and homosexuality. Homosexuality is not so much a type of sexual drive as it is the expression of deeper needs: the desire for self-degradation, or the seeking of a partner whom one can humiliate and degrade. It could hardly be unexpected that such a ruling class would eagerly hail the 20th century crusade to enthrone communism as the vehicle of the world order. In their quest for wealth, the Rothschilds did not overlook either the small farmer or the stockpiling and wholesaling of grain. They developed a farm loan system which has been the curse of the farmers for more than a century. R.F. Pettigrew noted in the British Guardian, "This system of banking, causing the ultimate ruin of all those who cultivate the soil, was the invention of Lord Overstone, with the assistance of the Rothschilds, bankers of Europe." One of their greatest triumphs was the successful outcome of the Rothschilds' protracted war against the Russian imperial family. The family name of the Romanovs was derived from Romanova, New Rome. It embodied the ancient prophecy that Moscow was to become the new Rome. The family originated with Prince Prus, brother of Emperor August of Rome, who founded Prussia. In 1614, Michael became the first Romanov Tsar. After the fall of Napoleon, the Rothschilds turned all their hatred against the Romanovs. In 1825, they poisoned Alexander I, in 1855, they poisoned Nicholas I. Other assassinations followed, culminating on the night of November 6, 1917, when a dozen Red Guards drove a truck up to the Imperial Bank building in Moscow. They loaded the imperial jewel collection and $700 million gold, loot totaling more than $1 billion. The new regime also confiscated the 150 million acres in Russia personally owned by the Tsar. Of equal importance were the enormous cash reserves which the Tsar had invested abroad in European and American banks. The New York Times stated that the Tsar had $5 million in guarantee trust, and $1 million in the National City Bank. Other authorities stated it was $5 million in each bank. Between 1905 and 1910, the Tsar had sent more than $900 million to be deposited in six leading New York banks: Chase, National City, Guarantee Trust, J.P. Morgan, Hanover, and Manufacturers Trust. These were the principal banks controlled by the House of Rothschild through their American agents, J.P. Morgan, and Kuhn, Loeb Company. These were also the six New York banks which bought the controlling stock in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York in 1914. They have held control of the stock ever since. The Tsar also had $115 million in four English banks. He had $35 million in the Bank of England, $25 million in Barings, $25 million in Barclays, and $30 million in Lloyds Bank. In Paris, the Tsar had $100 million in Banque de France, and $80 million in the Rothschild Bank of Paris. In Berlin, he had $132 million in the Mendelssohn Bank, which had long been bankers to Russia. None of these sums has ever been disbursed at compound interest since 1916. They amount to more than $50 billion. Two claimants later appeared, a son, Alexis, and a daughter, Anastasia. Despite a great deal of proof substantiating their claims, Peter Kurth notes in Anastasia that Lord Mountbatten put up the money for court battles against Anastasia. Although he was Empress Alexandra's nephew, he was the guiding force behind Anastasia's opposition. The Battenbergs, or Mountbattens, were also related to the Rothschild family. They did not wish to see the Tsar's fortune reclaimed and removed from the Rothschild banks. Kurth also notes in a 1959 series on the history of the great British banks, for example, the Observer of London remarked of Baring Brothers, the Romaniffs were among their most distinguished clients. It is affirmed that Baring's still holds a deposit of more than £40 million that was left them by the Romaniffs. Anthony Sampson, editor-in-chief, said no protests were made. This story is generally considered to be true. In the early 19th century, the Rothschilds began to consolidate their profits from government loans into various business ventures, which have done very well. Fortuitous trading on the London Stock Exchange after Waterloo gave Nathaniel Meyer Rothschild a sizable portion of the consols, which form the bulk of the deposits of the Bank of England. Joseph Wechsberg notes in The Merchant Bankers, there is the Sun Alliance Life Insurance Company, most aristocratic of all insurance companies, founded by Nathan Rothschild in 1824, Brinko, the British and Newfoundland Corporation founded by the British and French Rothschilds in 1952, the Anglo-American Corporation Bowater, Rio Tinto and others. Not only does the bank rate of the Bank of England affect the interest rates in other nations, the price of gold also plays a crucial role in the monetary affairs of nations, even if they are no longer on the gold standard. The dominant role played by the House of Rothschild in the Bank of England is augmented by another peculiar duty of the firm, the daily fixing of the world price of gold. The News Chronicle of December 12, 1938, describes this ritual. The story of the gold fixing has often been told. How every weekday at 11 a.m., the representatives of five firms of bullion brokers and one firm of refiners meet at the office of Messrs. Rothschild, except on Saturday, and there fix the sterling price of gold. There is, however, a great deal of activity which lies behind his final act, this centralization of the demand for, and the supply of gold in one office and the fixing of the price of gold on that basis. A price of gold is first suggested, probably by the representative of Messrs. Rothschild, who also acts for the Bank of England and the Exchange Equalization Account. The banking houses privileged to meet with the Rothschilds to set the world price of gold are known as the Club of Five. In 1958, they were N.M. Rothschild, Samuel Montague, Mocatta and Goldsmid, Sharp Spixley, and Johnson, Math. In 1961, the London accepting houses operating by approval of the Governor of the Bank of England were Barings, Brown, Shipley, Arbuthnot Latham, W.M. Brants and Sons, Mlanners, Anthony Gibbs and Company, Guinness Marr and Hawkins, S. Jaffate, Clwert and Sons, Lazard Brothers, Samuel Montague, Morgan Grenfell, N.M. Rothschild, M. Samuel, J. Henry Schroeder, and S.G. Warburg. These chosen firms rule the financial establishment in the City of London. In 1961, the leading business groups in England were listed by W.M. M. Clark as 1. Morgan Grenfell Limited to Lord Bicester, the Peabody J.P. Morgan Firm, 2. Jardine Matheson, 3. Rothschild Samuel Oppenheimer, comprising Rio Tinto, British South Africa Company Shell Peter Alliam, Brinko, British and Newfoundland Corporation 4. Lazard Brothers Shell, English Electric, Canadian Eagle Oil, 5. Lloyds Bank, 6. Barclays Bank, 7. Peninsula and Orient Lines, 8. Cunard, 9. Midland Group, Eagle Star, Higginson, Cavendish Bent Inc., 10. Prudential, 11. Imperial Chemical Industries, 12. Burwater, 13. Courts, 14. Unilever. Although this list shows the Rothschild Group as only one of 14, in fact they hold large positions or influence in the other groups of this list. In 1982, the principal directorships held by the London Rothschilds were Lord Rothschild, N.M., Rothschild and Sons, Arcan N.V., Curaçao, C.H.M.N., Rothschild's continuation, and Rothschild Incorporated USA. Edmund Leopold de Rothschild, N.M. Rothschild & Sons, Alfred Dunhill Limited Rothschild Continuation, Rothschild Trust, Rothmans International, CHMN Tokyo Pacific Holdings N.V., Baron Eric Rothschild, N.M. Rothschild & Sons, Evelyn de Rothschild, CHMBN.M. Rothschild & Sons, De Beers Consolidated Mines Limited South Africa, Eagle Star Insurance Company CHMN The Economist Newspaper Limited IBM UK Limited La Banque Privée SA Manufacturers Hanover Limited Rothschild Continuation Limited CHMN United Race Courses Limited, Leopold de Rothschild, N.M. Rothschild & Sons, Alliance Assurance Company Bank of England, The London Assurance, Rothschild Continuation Limited, Rothschild Continuation Holdings AG Switzerland, Sun Alliance and London Assurance Company Sun Insurance Office Limited The British firms comprising the major basis of the Rothschild fortune are, Sun Alliance Assurance, Eagle Star, De Beers, and Rio Tinto. Eagle Star's directors include Duncan McKinnon, of Hambro Investment Trust, Earl K. Doggan, whose mother was a Hambro, Sir Robert Clark, CHMN. Hill Samuel Company Marquis Linlithgow, Charles Hope, whose mother was a Milner, he married Judith Baring, Evelyn de Rothschild, and Sir Ian Stewart of Brown Shipley Company who has been Parliamentary Private Secretary to the Chancellor of the Exchequer since 1979. De Beers directors include Harry F. Oppenheimer, Sir Philip Oppenheimer, A.E. Oppenheimer, N.F. Oppenheimer, Baron Evelyn de Rothschild, and Sidney Spiro. Spiro is also a director of Rio Tinto, Hambro's Bank, Barclays Bank, and Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce. De Beers interlocks with Anglo-American Corporation of South Africa, of which Harry F. Oppenheimer is chairman, and Anglo-American Gold Investment Company of which Julian Ogilvy Thompson is chairman, and Harry F. Oppenheimer director. De Beers interlocks with Hambro's Bank, whose CHMN is Jocelyn Hambro, directors RRN. Hambro, C.E. Hambro, Honorable H.W. Astor, Sir Ian Morrow, CHMN. Ucoent. And the Laird Group, International Harvester, Rolls-Royce, and the Brush Group, J.M. Clay, Director of the Bank of England, Mark Weinberg, and Sidney Spiro. Rio Tinto's CHMN is Sir Anthony Tuke. He is also CHMN. Barclays Bank, and Member Trilateral Commission. Directors are Lord Shackleton, Lord Privy Seal, CHMN. RTZ Dev. Corporation Lord Charteris of Armesfield, grandson of Earl of Wems, married to daughter of Viscount Margeson, private secretary to Queen Elizabeth, director of Claridge's Hotel, and Connaught Hotel, Sir David Orr, CHMN. Unilever, and Sidney Spiro, Hambro's Bank. The principal Rothschild firm is Sun Alliance Assurance, which Nathan Meyer Rothschild founded in 1824, with Sir Alex Baring, Samuel Gurney, and Sir Moses Montefiore, with an initial capital of £5 million. CHMN. Of Sun Alliance is Lord Orlington, Toby Lowe, who is also CHMN. Westland Aircraft. director of Citibank, Citicorp, and G Limited, Lord Abercornway, Dep. CHMN. HVA. Lambert, CHMN. Barclays Bank, Earl of Crawford, Robert A. Lindsay, whose mother was a Cavendish. He is also CHMN. National Westminster Bank, former private secretary to the Secretary of Treasury. Minister of State for Defence, Minister of State for Foreign and Commercial Affairs, Lord Astor, whose mother was the daughter of Earl of Minto. He is the former chairman of The Times. Sir Charles Ball, of Clwyd Benson, also director of Chubb and Sons. Barclays Bank, Cadbury Shveppy, Sir Alan Dalton, director Natal. Westminster Bank, Duke of Devonshire, his mother was a Cecil, one of England's three ruling families since the Middle Ages, Sir Derek Holden Brown, CHMN. Allied Breweries, director Hiram Walker, J&C. James, trustee Grosvenor Estates, which owns large sections of London, Henry Keswick, CHMN. Matheson and Company, Lord Kindersley, exec. Director of Lassie Brothers, director of Marconi, English Electric, British Match, Swedish Match. Sir Peter Matthews, CHMN. Vickers, J.M. Ritchie, CHMN. British Incolon, director of Vickers, Bowater Limited, Evelyn de Rothschild, CHMN. N.M. Rothschild and Sons. The Rothschilds have had a large position in Vickers for many years. CHMN. Is Sir Peter Matthews, also director Lloyds Bank and Sun Alliance. Directors are T. Neville, Baron Braybrooke, Earl of Warwick, the Salisburys, one of three ruling families in England, Sir Alistair Frame, Chief Exec. Rio Tinto's Inc., Director of Plessy and Company UK, and the Atomic Energy Authority. CHMN. Of Vickers in 1956 was Edward Knollys, son of the private secretary to King Edward V 40 years, and George V 5 years. For more than a century, a widespread belief has been deliberately fostered in the United States that the Rothschilds were of little significance in the American financial scene. With this cover, they have been able to manipulate political and financial developments in this country to their own advantage. In 1837, the Rothschilds let their American representative, W.L. and M.S. Joseph, go bankrupt in the crash, while they threw their cash reserves behind a newcomer, August Belmont, and their secret representative, George Peabody of London. Birmingham notes in Our Crowd, in the panic of 1837, Belmont was able to perform a service which he would repeat in subsequent panics, thanks to the hugeness of the Rothschild reservoir of capital, to start out in America operating his own Federal Reserve System. After 1837, August Belmont, Schnburg, was publicly advertised in the financial press as the American representative of the Rothschilds. When Belmont participated in a financial operation, everyone knew that the Rothschilds were involved. When Belmont took no part, and the transaction was handled by J.P. Morgan and Company and or by Kuhn, Loeb Company, everyone knew that the Rothschilds were not involved. George Peabody had established his business in England through his connection with Brown Brothers, now Brown Brothers Harriman and Brown, Shipley. He had become an unidentified agent for Lord Rothschild as early as 1835. Although there is no statue of George Peabody in the Wall Street area, there is one in London, just opposite the Bank of England. George Peabody became the favorite American of Queen Victoria. His old lunchbox occupies a prominent place in the London office of Morgan Stanley to this day. By 1861, George Peabody had become the largest trader of American securities in the world. To put pressure on the Lincoln government, he began unloading them and driving prices down. At the same time, J.P. Morgan, allied with Morris Ketchum, was depleting the American gold supply by shipping it to England. He ran the price from $126 ounce to $171 ounce, reaping a good profit, and putting more financial pressure on the Lincoln government. This was one of many financial operations directed by the Rothschilds for their own political and financial goals. As George Peabody had no son to take over his firm, he took on Junius Morgan as partner. Junius' son John Pierpont Morgan became known as the most powerful banker in the world, although his principal role was to secretly carry out commissions for the House of Rothschild. The New York Times, October 26, 1907, noted in connection with J.P. Morgan's actions during the Panic of 1907, in conversation with the New York Times correspondent, Lord Rothschild paid a high tribute to J.P. Morgan for his efforts in the present financial juncture in New York. He is worthy of his reputation as a great financier and a man of wonders. His latest action fills one with admiration and respect for him. This is the only recorded instance when a Rothschild praised any bank outside of his own family. On March 28, 1932, the New York Times noted, London, N.M. Victor Rothschild, 21-year-old nephew of Baron Rothschild, is going to the United States soon to take a post with J.P. Morgan and Company, it was learned tonight. It is usual for progressive British bankers to send their young men to Western states temporarily, one of the most notable believers in the practice being the Anglo-American banking house of J. Henry Schroeder and Company. The Morgan-Rothschild connection explains the otherwise incomprehensible mystery of why J.P. Morgan, famed as the most powerful banker in the world, left such a modest fortune at his death in 1913, a mere $11 million after his debts were secured. Although the present members of the Morgan family seem financially secure, none of them is counted among the big rich. In Brandeis, A Free Man's Life, Arpheus T. Mason notes, young Adolf Brandeis, Justice Brandeis' father, arrived in New York, traveled for a while in the East and then went on to the Midwest. Young Brandeis' pleasure and facility in travel were greatly enhanced by the companionship of a young friend of the Wales, then on a business trip to the United States to secure information about American investments for the House of Rothschild. Thanks to his companion's contacts and letters of introduction, Adolf saw places and met people not accessible to most foreigners. Birmingham notes in Our Crowd, in the autumn of 1874, Baron Rothschild summoned Isaac Seligman to his office, some $55 million of U.S. bonds were to be offered by three houses, the House of Seligman, the House of Morgan, and the House of Rothschild. This was the first time that the Seligmans had been asked to participate in an issue with the Rothschilds. They were more than grateful, and thus another ally of the Rothschilds began to operate in America. A notable advantage of J.P. Morgan's work for the House of Rothschild was the carefully cultivated belief that Morgan, if not openly anti-Semitic, avoided participating in operations with Jewish banking firms, and that his firm would not hire anyone of Jewish background. It was the same deception which Nathan Meyer Rothschild had hired Morgan's predecessor, George Peabody, to perform in London. It was a traditional belief on Wall Street that if you wished to deal with a Gentiles-only firm, you went to J.P. Morgan. If you wanted a Jewish firm, there were a number of houses available, but the most influential, by far, was Kuhn, Loeb Company. In either case, the customer was never made aware that he was dealing with an American representative of the House of Rothschild. Jacob Siff, who brought the Kuhn, Loeb firm to its preeminent role in American finance, was born in the Rothschild house at 148 Judengasse, Frankfurt, which the Rothschilds shared with the Siff family. In 1867, Abraham Kuhn and Solomon Loeb, two Cincinnati dry goods merchants, founded the banking house of Kuhn, Loeb. In 1875, Jacob Siff arrived from Frankfurt to join the firm. he married Thries, Solomon's daughter. He also brought a large amount of Rothschild capital into the firm, enabling it to expand tenfold. In 1885, Loeb retired. Jacob Siff ran the firm from 1885 to 1920, when he died. At no time has the House of Rothschild ever indicated publicly that it had any interest in the firm of Kuhn, Loeb Company George R. Conroy stated in Truth Magazine, Boston, December 16, 1912, Mr. Siff is head of the great private banking house of Kuhn, Loeb and Company, which represents the Rothschild interests on this side of the Atlantic. He has been described as a financial strategist and has been for years the financial minister of the great impersonal power known as Standard Oil. He was hand in glove with the Harrimans, the Goulds and the Rockefellers in all their railroad enterprises and has become the dominant power in the railroad and financial world of America. Chapter 1, The Rothschilds, Part 2. This is one more revelation of the hidden power of the Rothschild interests in America. Not only has it directed the Rockefeller enterprises from the time that National City Bank of Cleveland, a Rothschild bank, financed the early expansion of Rockefeller, South Improvement Company, which enabled him to crush his competitors through illegal railway rebates, but it has also been the power behind the scenes of the Harriman fortunes, now Brown Brothers Harriman. It explains the frequent appointments, never elections, of W. Averill Harriman, the dominant power in the Democratic Party, while his partner's son, George Bush, is the Republican vice president, a heartbeat away from the presidency of the United States. It explains the secret writing of the Federal Reserve Act by Paul Warburg of Kuhn, Loeb and Company, and the even more secret deals which caused it to be enacted into law by Congress. It explains how the United States could fight World War I with Paul Warburg in charge of its banking system through the vice chairmanship of the Federal Reserve Board, Bernard Baruch as dictator of American industry as chairman of the War Industries Board, and Eugene Meyer financing the war through his position as chairman of the War Finance Corporation, printing government bonds in duplicate. Kuhn, Loeb partner Sir William Wiseman with Colonel House correlated British and American intelligence operations. Kuhn, Loeb partner Louis L. Strauss was acting head of the U.S. Food Administration under Herbert Hoover. Meanwhile, Paul's brother, Max Warburg, headed the German espionage system. Another brother was German commercial attaché in Stockholm, traditional listening post for warring nations, and Jacob Siff had two brothers in Germany who were financing the German war effort. It was a classic case of a managed conflict, with the Rothschilds manipulating both sides from behind the scenes. At the Versailles Peace Conference, Bernard Baruch was head of the Reparations Commission. Max Warburg, on behalf of Germany, accepted the reparations terms, while Paul Warburg, Thomas Lamont and other Wall Street bankers advised Wilson and the Dulles brothers on how American interests should be handled at this all-important diplomatic conference. The Rothschilds had decided upon the formula of a managed conflict for the First World War because of the difficulty they had encountered in defeating the Boers from 1899 to 1901. After illegally annexing the Transvaal in 1881, the British had been turned back with a resounding defeat at Majuba by Paul Kruger. In 1889, because of the discovery of vast wealth in gold and diamonds in South Africa, the Rothschilds came back to loot the nation with 400,000 British soldiers pitted against 30,000 irregulars, that is, farmers with rifles, whom the Boers could put into the field. The Boer War was started by Rothschild's agent, Lord Alfred Milner, against the wishes of a majority of the British people. His plans were aided by another Rothschild agent, Cecil Rhodes, who later left his entire fortune to the furtherance of the Rothschild program, through the Rhodes Trust, a by no means infrequent denouement among Rothschild agents, and the basis of the entire foundation empire today. The British fought in no prisoners, scorched earth war, destroying farms, and mercilessly shooting down Boers who tried to surrender. It was in this war that the institution of concentration camps was brought to the world, as the British rounded up and imprisoned in unsanitary, fever-ridden camps anyone thought to be sympathetic to the Boers, including many women and children, who died by the thousands. This genocidal policy would next be used by the Rothschild-financed Bolsheviks in Russia, who adopted the Boer War concept to murder 66 million Russians between 1917 and 1967. There was never any popular reaction to either of these atrocities, because of the control of media which makes discussion of these calamities a taboo subject. The career of Lord Alfred Milner, 1854-1925, began when he was a protégé of Sir Evelyn Baring, the first Earl of Cromer, partner of Baring Brothers Bankers, who had been appointed Director General of Accounts in Egypt. Baring was then the financial advisor of the Khedive of Egypt. Since 1864, Milner had been active in the Colonial Society, founded in London in that year. In 1868, it was renamed the Royal Colonial Institute, and was heavily financed by Barclays Bank, and by the Barings, Sassoons and Jardine Matheson, all of whom were active in founding the Hong Kong Shanghai Bank, and who were heavily interested in the Asiatic drug traffic. The staff economist of the Royal Colonial Society was Alfred Marshall, founder of the monetarist theory which Milton Friedman now peddles under the aegis of the Hoover Institution and other supposedly right-wing think tanks. Marshall, through the Oxford Group, became the patron of Wesley Clair Mitchell, who then taught Burns and Friedman. In 1884, Milner augmented the work of the Royal Colonial Society with an inner group, the Imperial Federation League. Both groups now function as the Royal Empire Society. Vladimir Halperin, in Lord Milner and the Empire, writes, "It was through Milner and some of his friends that the Round Table Group came into being." The Round Table, it should be said, is an authority to this day on all Commonwealth interests. He states that Milner raised a considerable sum for the work of the Round Table, including £30,000 from Lord Astor, £10,000 from Lord Rothschild, £10,000 from the Duke of Bedford, and £10,000 from a Lord Ive. Milner launched a magazine called the Empire Review, later called the Round Table Quarterly. Halperin also notes another contribution of Milner. He played an important part in the drafting of the famous Balfour Declaration in December of 1917. It is a fact that, with Balfour, he was its co-author. As far back as 1915, Milner had realized the need for a Jewish national home, and had never ceased to be warmly in favor of its creation. Milner, like Lloyd George, Emery, and many others, saw that the Jewish national home could also contribute to the security of the empire in the Near East. The Milner Round Table later became the Royal Institute of International Affairs Council on Foreign Relations Combine, which exercises unopposed control for the world order over foreign and monetary policy in both the United States and Great Britain. Milner trained a group of ambitious young men who became known as his kindergarten. It included John Buchan, future Governor General of Canada, Geoffrey Dawson, later editor of the Times, and prominent supporter of appeasement with the Cliveden set led by Lord Astor, who owned the Times, Philip Kerr, 11th Marquess, Lord Lothian, the youngest member of the kindergarten. He served as private secretary to Lloyd George from 1916 to 20, and was given credit as largely responsible for the German provisions of the Treaty of Versailles. His Hoosier goes on to say that he played an important part in dealing with India, all dominions, and the United States. He was ambassador to the United States 1935-40, and was a close friend of Waldorf and Lady Astor. George Cheechem Goschen, a liberal who was hailed as the greatest Chancellor of the Exchequer, head of the Cunliffe Goschen Banking House with Lord Cunliffe, Governor of the Bank of England. Goschen was also Chancellor of Oxford and the University of Edinburgh. His brother, Baron Sir Edward Goschen was ambassador to Berlin when Bethmann Hollweg told him that the Belgian treaty was a mere scrap of paper. Leopold S. Emery, who had two sons, Leopold, who was executed as a traitor in 1945, and Julian, who married Prime Minister Harold Macmillan's daughter, and served as left-wing correspondent on the Spanish front 1938-9, Churchill's personal representative to Chiang Kai-shek, 1945, Round Table Conference on Malta, 1955, Council of Europe, 1950-56. The senior Leopold Emery is described as a passionate advocate of British imperialism. He was on the staff of the Times, and wrote a 7-volume history of the South African War for the Times, served in the cabinet from 1916-22, MP 1911-45, First Lord of Admiralty, 1922-24, Secretary of State for India, 1940-45, and arranged for India to have independence. He was a trustee of the Rhodes Trust. The Milner-Rothschild relationship was described in Terence O'Brien's biography, Milner, p. 97. Milner went to Paris on some business with Alpenster Rothschild. Business calls in the city included a formal visit to Rothschild's weekend with Lord Rothschild at Turing, and visit with Edward Cecil, Lord Salisbury at Hatfield. While spending a weekend with Lord Rothschild at Turing, a press lord gave him a sleepless night, no further explanation given. Talks with Rothschild. Milner attended a Zionist dinner given by Lord Rothschild, sitting next to Lawrence of Arabia, who interpreted for him in a talk with King Faisal. On p. 364, O'Brien notes, Milner lost no time in recreating his links with the city. He went first to Rio Tinto, which re-elected him to its board, and before long Rothschild asked him to be its chairman. Rio Tinto was one of the key firms in the Rothschild empire. Herbert Hoover was also appointed a director of Rio Tinto. He would soon be asked to head the Belgian Relief Commission, which prolonged World War I from 1916-1918. The Milner role in starting the South African War is described in British Supremacy in South Africa. Chap. 1 is headed Sir Alfred Milner's War, explained as follows. On 19 March, Chamberlain telegraphed to him, "The principal object of His Majesty's government in South Africa is peace. Nothing but a most flagrant offence would justify the use of force." P. 22, Milner had come to believe that war with the Transvaal was both inevitable and desirable. Milner had at last convinced Chamberlain that British supremacy in South Africa would be jeopardized unless the power of the Transvaal was broken. There is the evidence that Rothschild's roundtable minion, Milner, cold-bloodedly precipitated the Boer War for his master's gain. John Hayes Hammond, chief mining engineer for the House of Rothschild, also was sent to South Africa to precipitate the war. He formed the Uitlanders Reform Committee, with Lionel Phillips, head of gold and diamond mining firm Eckstein the Corner House, George Farrer of East Rand Property Mines, and Colonel Frank Rhodes, brother of Cecil Rhodes. The committee was financed by A. Bailey, Sir Joel, Barney Barnato, and the Ecksteins, all of whom were big winners in the partition of the gold and diamond properties after the war. During this activity, Hammond was arrested by Paul Kruger, sentenced to death for promoting revolution, and was allowed to leave only after paying a $100,000 fine. He was then hired by the Guggins at $500,000 a year salary, and in 1921 became chief lobbyist for the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. Like other enterprises with which the Rothschilds have been connected, the Bank of England has been a centre of international intrigue and espionage since its founding in 1694. Although the Rothschilds did not become associated with the bank until 1812, when Nathan Meyer Rothschild increased his fortune 6,500 times by taking advantage of false rumours that somehow swept the London Stock Exchange, purporting that England had lost at Waterloo. The Bank of England originated in a revolution, when William E., Prince of Orange, drove King James VI from the throne. Since the Bank of England charter was granted by William in 1694, there has never been another revolt against the crown. The royal family has been secure because the source of money, crucial to a revolution, has remained under control. King Charles VIII had managed to retain a shaky position because of support from the Duke of Buckingham, George Vares, and others whose first names formed the word cabal, introducing a new term for intrigue. His successor, James VIII, tried to placate the powerful lords of England, but even his long-time supporters, scenting a change of power, began secret negotiations with the Prince of Orange. Wilhelm I, Prince of Orange, had been married several times, to Anne of Saxony, Charlotte de Bourbon, and Princess de Coligny. Today, every ruling house of Europe, as well as those out of power, is a direct descendant of King William, including Queen Juliana of the Netherlands, Margrethe, Queen of Denmark, Olaf V of Norway, Gustav of Sweden, Constantine of Greece, Prince Rainier of Monaco, and Jean, Grand Duke of Luxembourg, whose son married the daughter of C. Douglas Dillon. Lord Shrewsbury, Charles Talbot, had been given places by both Charles A and James A. Nevertheless, he played a leading role in the revolution. He took £12,000 to Holland to support William in 1688, returned with him, and was made Secretary of State. Sidney Godolphin, one of James VIII's last adherents, joined with the Duke of Sunderland and the Duchess of Portsmouth in correspondence with William prior to his invasion of England, and was appointed head of the Treasury by William. Henry Compton, Earl of Northampton, and Bishop of London, had been removed by James VIII. He signed the invitation to William to come to England. He was reinstated in his see in 1688. His son Francis became a Lord Privy Seal. John Churchill, 1st Duke of Marlborough, had entered into negotiations with the Prince of Orange in October 1687, and expressed his readiness to support him in August 1688. To allay James VIII's suspicions, Marlborough then signed a renewed oath of fidelity to him November 10, 1688. On November 24, 1688, he joined the forces of William of Orange. Although William had married Mary, the daughter of James VIII, and had a legitimate claim to the throne of England, he could not take power as long as James VIII was on the throne. Therefore, he entered England with a force of 10,000 foot soldiers and 4,000 horse, a small force with which to conquer a great kingdom. With him were Churchill, Bentinck, the 1st Earl of Portland, Earl of Shrewsbury, and Lord Polwart, whose descendant is a prominent member of the Anglo-American banking establishment. James VIII fled to the court of Louisville and was declared abdicated. Marlborough, ancestor of Winston Churchill, whose former daughter-in-law, Pam Harriman, is the leading power in the Democratic Party, is described in The Captain General, by Ivor Brown, the Commissioner of Public Accounts found that the Duke of Marlborough had accepted gifts amounting to some £60,000 from Antonio Mercado and Sir Solomon de Medina, contractors for bread and wagons for the army abroad, and 2% of all money allotted for payment of troops, some £175,000, later revised to £350,000. Marlborough claimed it had all been spent for intelligence, but witnesses testified he could not have spent more than £5,000 for this purpose in all of his campaigns. Donald Chandler's biography of Marlborough points out that the bread contractors such as Solomon and Moses Medina, Mynheer Hecop, Solomon Abraham, Vandeker and Mercado, were for the most part Spanish or Dutch Jews of varying reliability and venality. Chandler says that they consistently gave short weight or added sand to their corn sacks. For a number of years, Medina, as chief army contractor, contributed an annual commission of £6,000 a year to Marlborough as his rate off on army contracts. In addition to his English supporters, who were previously loyal to King James VIII, William brought with him from Amsterdam the group of avaricious financiers who were also the suppliers of his armies. One of his first official acts was the conferring of knighthood on Solomon de Medina. Mercado and Pereira provisioned his armies in Spain and Holland, Medina supplied Marlborough in Flanders, Joseph Cortisot supplied Lord Galway in Spain, and Abraham Prado supplied the British army during the Seven-Year War. The most important act of William's reign was his granting of the Charter of the Bank of England in 1694, although most of his biographers omit this salient fact. The concept of a central bank which would have the power of note issue, or issuing money, had already taken hold in Europe. The Bank of Amsterdam was started in 1609, its members aided William in his conquest of England. The Bank of Hamburg was chartered in 1619, the Bank of Sweden began the practice of issuing notes in 1661. These banks were chartered by financiers whose ancestors had been bankers in Venice and Genoa. As the tide of world power shifted northward in Europe, so did the financiers. The Warburgs of Hamburg had begun as the Abraham del Banco family, the largest bankers in Venice. An interesting technique is revealed by the Charter of the Bank of England. It was slipped through as part of a dunnage bill, which was later to become a recognized parliamentary technique. The charter provides that rates and duties upon tonnage of ships are made security to such persons as shall voluntarily advance the sum of £1,500,000 towards carrying on the war against France. Other European banks, such as the banks of Genoa, Venice and Amsterdam, were primarily banks of deposit, but the Bank of England began the practice of coining its own credit into money, the beginning of the monetarist movement. The Bank of England soon created a new class of moneyed interests in the city, as opposed to the power of the old barons, whose fortunes derived from their landholdings. Of the 500 original stockholders, 450 lived in London. This was the dawn of the preeminence of the city, now the world's leading financial center. For this reason, the Rothschilds identified their key American banks with the code word City. Early descriptions of the shareholders of the Bank of England identify them as a society of about 1,300 persons. They included the King and Queen of England, who received shares to the value of £10,000 each, Marlborough, who invested £10,000. He also invested large sums from his commissions in the East India Company in 1697, and later became governor of the Hudson Bay Company, which paid a 75% dividend, Lord Shrewsbury, who invested £10,000, Godolphin, who invested £7,000. He predicted that the Bank of England would not only finance trade, but would carry the burden of her wars, which was proven true in the next 300 years. Virginia Cowles writes, "In the Great Marlborough, England emerged from the war as the dominant force, because the Bank of England's credit system enabled her to bear the burden of war without undue strain." Other charter subscribers were William Bentinck, later the first Earl of Portland. He had been a page in William of Orange's household, accompanied William to England in 1670 on his initial visit, handled the delicate negotiations of his marriage with Mary in 1677, and prepared the details of William's invasion of England. He was given the title of Earl of Portland, and became the most trusted agent of William's foreign policy. In 1984, we find the ninth Duke, Cavendish Bentinck, is CHMN of Bayer's UK Limited, and Nuclear Chemie Mitchorp GmbH, Germany. He also had a distinguished career in foreign service. Joining the Foreign Office in 1922, he represented England at the successive Paris, Hague and Locarno conferences, was CHMN Joint Intelligence for the Chief SOPOUND Staff 1939-45, and Ambassador to Poland during the critical years of 1945-47, when that country was turned over to the Soviet Union, with England's surreptitious support. Other charter subscribers to the Bank of England were the Duke of Devonshire, William Cavendish, who built Chatsworth, He also had signed the invitation to William to assume the throne of England. He was High Steward at Anne's coronation in 1702, and was said to lead a profligate private life. The present Duke sold 7 drawings in July 1984 for $9.2 million. The 11th Duke married Deborah Freeman Mitford, daughter of Baron Redesdale. His present brother-in-law, Baron Redesdale, is Vice President of Chase Manhattan Bank, the Duke of Leeds, Sir Thomas Osborne, who also signed the invitation to William. He was Lord High Treasurer and had arranged the marriage of Mary. He was later impeached for receiving a large bribe to procure charter of the East India Company in 1691. Because of his favoured position at court, the proceedings were never concluded, and he left one of the largest fortunes in England, Earl of Pembroke, Thomas Herbert, who became the first Lord of the Admiralty, and later Lord Privy Seal, Earl of Carnarvon, who is also Earl of Powys and Earl of Bradford. Lord Edward Russell, created Earl of Orford 1697. He had joined the service of William in 1683, was appointed Treasurer of the Navy 1689, First Lord of Admiralty 1696-17, and Lord Justice 1697-1714. Sir Robert Walpole, the famed British leader, was created Earl of Orford in the second creation. William Paterson, usually credited with being the founder of the Bank of England, he was forced out within a year. Sir Theodore Janssen, who invested £10,000. Dr. Hugh Chamberlain, John Haskell, an eccentric writer and pamphleteer. Dr. Nicholas Barbon, son of Praisiger Barebones, who started the first insurance company in Great Britain. John Holland, a reputed Englishman who also started the Bank of Scotland in 1695. Michael Godfrey, who died at Namur, Belgium on his way to Antwerp to establish a branch of the Bank of England. He was the first deputy governor of the Bank of England, and nephew of Sir Edward Godfrey, who was murdered by Titus Oakes in 1678. Sir John Hublong and 20 members of his family were also early stockholders. Sir John became a Lord of the Admiralty, and Lord Mayor of London. His brother James was Deputy Governor of the Bank of England. Salomon de Medina, later knighted by William E. Sir William Scorn, Sir Gilbert Heathcote, Director of Bank of England 1699-1701, and from 1723-25. He was Sheriff and later Lord Mayor of London, founded the New East India Company in 1693. His parsimony was ridiculed by Alexander Pope in his Quatrains. Sir Charles Montagu, 1st Earl of Halifax, and Chancellor of the Exchequer. The present Earl is a director of Hambro's Bank. Marquis Normandy, John Sheffield, also held the title of Duke of Buckingham. He is buried in Westminster Abbey. Thomas Howard, Earl of Arundel, controller of the royal household. Charles Chaplin, and the philosopher, John Locke. In his The Bank of England, A History, Sir John Clapham notes that by 1721, a number of Spanish and Portuguese Jews had been buying stock in the Bank of England. Medina, 2 de Costas, Fonseca, Henriquez, Mendez, Nunes, Rodriguez, Salvador Teixeira de Mats, Jacob and Theodore Jacobs, Moses and Jacob Abravanel, Francis Pereira. Clapham notes that since 1751 there has been very little trading in Bank of England stock. It has been very closely held for more than 2 centuries. The Bank of England has played a prominent role in American history. Without it, the United States would not exist. The American colonists considered themselves loyal Englishmen to a man, but when they began to enjoy unequaled prosperity by printing and circulating their own colonial scrip, the stockholders of the Bank of England went to George E. and informed him that their monopoly of interest-bearing notes in the colonies was at stake. He banned the scrip, with the result that there was an immediate depression in the commercial life of the Americas. This was the cause of the rebellion. As Benjamin Franklin pointed out, the little tax on tea, amounting to about $1 a year per American family, could have been borne, but the colonists could not survive the banning of their own money. the Bank of England and the Rothschilds continued to play a dominant role in the commercial life of the United States, causing panics and depressions for the Rothschilds whenever their officials were instructed to do so. When the Second Bank of the United States expired in 1836, and President Jackson refused to renew it, creating great prosperity in the United States when government funds were deposited in other banks, the Rothschilds punished the upstarts by causing the Panic of 1837. As Henry Clews writes, 28 Years on Wall Street, p. 157. The Panic of 1837 was aggravated by the Bank of England when it in one day threw out all the paper connected with the United States. By refusing to credit American notes and stocks, the Bank of England created financial panic among the holders of that paper. The panic enabled Rothschild's agents, Peabody and Belmont, to reap a fortune in buying up depreciated stocks during the panic. The Bank of England has played a prominent role in wars, revolutions, and espionage, as well as business panics. When Napoleon escaped from Elba in 1815, the London gold market jumped overnight from 41b.60 to £5.7. The leading buyer was Nathan Meyer Rothschild, who was under orders from the British Treasury to dispatch gold to the Duke of Wellington, grouping to stop Napoleon. After Waterloo, the price of gold dropped. During the 20th century, the most important name at the Bank of England was Lord Montagu Norman. His grandfather, George Wars Norman, had been governor of the Bank of England from 1821 to 1872, longer than any other man. His other grandfather, Lord Collett, was governor of the Bank of England from 1887 to 1889, and managing partner of Brown Shipley Company in London for 25 years. In 1894, Montagu Norman was sent to New York to work in the offices of Brown Brothers. He was befriended by the W.A. Delano family, and lived with the Marco family, partners of Brown Brothers in 1907. Norman was elected to the court of the Bank of England. In 1912, he had a severe nervous breakdown, and was treated by Jung in Switzerland. He became deputy governor of the Bank of England in 1916, and later served until 1944 as governor. The Wall Street Journal wrote of him in 1927, "Mr. M. Collett Norman, the governor of the Bank of England, is now head and shoulders above all other British bankers. No other British banker has ever been as independent and supreme in the world of British finance as Mr. Norman is today. He has just been elected governor for the 8th year in succession. Before the war, no governor was allowed to hold office for more than 2 years, but Mr. Norman has broken all precedents. He runs his bank and his treasury as well. He appears to have no associations except his employees. He gives no interviews. He leaves the British financial world wholly in the thick as to his plans and ideas. The idea that one individual ran the Bank of England to suit himself, with no influences, is too ridiculous to be considered. What about the Rothschilds? What about the other shareholders?" Carol Quigley, in Tragedy and Hope, notes that M. Norman said, "I hold the hegemony of the currency. He is called the currency dictator of Europe." Lionel Fraser of J. Henry Schroeder Wagg notes in his autobiography, All to the Good, that he was in charge of Lord Norman's personal investments. He also notes of the firm of Helbert Wagg, former jewelers from Halberstadt and now a London banking house, later J. Henry Schroeder Wagg. The firm was official brokers on stock exchange to the great and all-powerful House of Rothschild. Both Wagg and Schroeder had been in business in London for 159 years when they merged in 1960. Another writer notes that Lord Norman frequently consulted with J.P. Morgan before making his Bank of England decisions. Gordon Richardson, chairman of J. Henry Schroeder from 1962 to 72, then became governor of the Bank of England from 1970 to 283, when he was succeeded by Robert Lee Pemberton, CHMN. of the National Westminster Bank, also director of Equitable. He married into the Cecil Burghley family. The present directors of the Bank of England are G.W. McMahon, deputy governor since 1964, economic analyst Treasury 1953-57, advisor British Embassy Washington 1957-60, Sir Adrian Cadbury, CHMN. Cadbury Schweppes, Der. IBM UK, Leopold de Rothschild, N.M. Rothschild & Sons etc., George V. Blunden, Exec. Der. Bank of England since 1947, served with IMF 1955-58, A.D. Lochness, Der. J. Henry Schroederwag, G.A. Drain, Member Trilateral Commission, Treasury European Movement, Franco-British Council, British North American Committee, lawyer for many unions and health associations. Sir Jasper Homme, has been on the board since 1936, D.G. Scholey, CHMN. S.G. Warburg Company Orion Insurance, Union Discount of London, Mercury Securities, which now owns S.G. Warburg Company Irwin Holdings, J.M. Clay, Dep. CHMN. Hambros Bank, CHMN. Johnson and Firth Brown Limited, Hambros Life Assurance, Sir David Steele, CHMN. British Petroleum, Der. Kuwait Oil Company The Wellcome Trust, Trustee The Economist, who's CHMN. Is Evelyn de Rothschild, Lord Nelson of Stafford, CHMN. G Limited CHMN. Royal Worcester Company NAT. Bank of Australasia, International Nickel, British Aircraft, English Electric, Marconi Limited CHMN. World Power Conference, Worshipful Company of Goldsmiths, Middle East and Arson, Lord Weir, CHMN. The Weir Group, CHMN. Great Northern Investment Trust, EAJ. George, Exec. Der Bank of England, Der. Gilt Edge Division Bank of England, IMF 1972-72, Bank for International Settlements 1966-69, Sir Hector Lane, CHMN. United Biscuit, Allied Leon, Royal Insurance, Sir Alistair Pilkington, CHMN. Pilkington Brothers Glass, Der. British Petroleum, British Railways Board. The Bank of England also dominates the Bank of Scotland, who's CHMN. Is Robert Bruce, Lord Balfour, his title Balfour of Burley was created in 1607, he is manager of English Electric and Viking Oil, he married the daughter of magnate E.S. Manus. Directors of Bank of Scotland include Lord Clydesmuir, also Der. Barclays Bank, and R.T. Honourable Lord Polwart, Director of Halliburton's, which interlocks with the Rothschild First City Bank of Houston and City Bank, Imperial Chemical Industries, Canadian Pacific, and Brown and Root Wimpey Highland Fabricators, which interlocks with George Wimpey PLC, largest construction firm in the British Empire, whose 44 companies have revenues of £1.2 billion per year. Lord Polwart's daughter married Baron Moran, High Commissioner of Canada, who previously served as ambassador to Hungary and to Chad. Baron Moran's daughter married Baron Mountevans, manager of Consolidated Goldfields. Directors of George Wimpey PLC included S.S. Jardine, Viscount Hood, who is CHMN. Petrofina UK, and Director J. Henry Schroederwag, and Union Minier, and Sir Joseph Latham, CHMN. Ariel International, Director Deutsches Kreditbank,